Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Rich Hall flew the Sky Raider called Sweet Marlene over Southeast Asia during the Vietnam War. As the Ken Burns and Lynn Novick documentary series airs on SDPB TV this week, we talk with those impacted by the war and about the legacy of Vietnam in South Dakota. Rich Hall joins me now in the SDPB studios at the University of Sioux Falls. Welcome.
Lori, thank you very much.
Thank you for being here.
I appreciate your having me here and being allowed to speak on behalf of some of the guys that I flew and worked with.
I was introduced to you via email by John Mollison, who is the host of Old Guys and Their Airplanes. He did a feature on you. He drew Sweet Marlene down to the scuff marks. On her, is it her nose?
On the cowling, that's correct.
Okay, and so we'll put a link up on our website after the show so people can really see that. So let's start there. Tell me a little bit about the experience of working with John and seeing the artistic rendition of the aircraft.
John is an amazing person, and I have no idea why he picked me out of the world. There are no Sky Raider pilots in the state of South Dakota. There were three at one time. But Danny Menke left, and there was a guy from Springfield by the name of Husingveld, and he left the state several years ago. So I'm the last one left.
All right. So what exactly is it, the Sky Raider?
It's a big old single-engine propeller-driven airplane that can soak up punishment like it's hard to believe. And the reason for the cowling name, Sweet Marlene, is my wife's name.
Yeah.
And my analysis of that, or my thought, if Yeager can have his wife's name on his airplane, I can have my wife on mine.
And she didn't even know that you had done that until later?
She was not aware of it until much later, yeah.
Right, so why do pilots do that?
It's a kind of a good luck token.
Yeah.
Marlene has been with me for 51 years now, and we've seen a lot of things.
Yeah.
And bless her heart for putting up with everything.
So what's the mission? You're not flying over Vietnam. Let's talk about what you did in Vietnam.
Okay. We had really two missions. We, as strike, worked for General Vang Pao in North Laos. And that was a kind of a circuitous operational path, but it worked. And we assisted them, the Laotians, as much as we possibly could. Our primary role was we were cover for the rescue helicopters for downed pilots in North Vietnam and North Laos. Now, this was an extremely difficult mission, and it required a certain mental flexibility in that you had to be able to adapt to whatever the changing situation was on the spot.
Hmm. Did you train for that? Did you get screened for that? Was that part of the, requirements and testing in order to do the job? Are they looking for you?
Thank you. I'll take that as a compliment, Lori. Thank you very much. No, it was done at the operational level. The Sandy pilots were picked out of the fighter squadron as guys that showed an ability to adapt. The analogy would be football. Mm-hmm. You analyze the situation around you and adapt, change the play to make it fit, make it work.
Situational awareness. Is what Clark Mola told us yesterday on the
precisely show. Correct. Situational awareness, exactly right.
All right, do you get that right away? I'm not done with that yet. Is that just where did that come from for you? That mental flexibility and that mental resilience to say the situation has changed and I will change with it.
I will adapt to it. Yes.
Yeah.
This is a very difficult thing to define, and it is not. Something that you can teach, per se. It's something you kind of acquire as you go along. Some guys show an aptitude for it, and some guys will never learn. Sorry about that.
Yeah.
As far as being selected, I did this out of pilot training by choice. Got into the Sky Raider. And once there, that's what I wanted to do, and I made it known that I wanted to be a Sandy before anything else. That was my goal. And fortunately, I had two old majors who were on my side, and who should probably remain nameless. And there were several folks that went out of their way to help this brash young captain on his first operational assignment.
All right, so Sandy is the call sign for the rescue.
For rescue.
Cover for rescue.
As a token of some kind of respect, the term Sandy, correction, a call sign, Sandy, is still in use to this day for fixed-wing aircraft involved in a rescue.
Hmm. How often do you have to rescue?
We pulled alert every day, and there were sometimes a day or two where we did not fly. And for that reason, we adapted by going out and flying a strike mission with the birds that had Sandy loads on them, so the weapons for the Sandy mission.
All right. What are the weapons?
Generally speaking, we carried two or three a white phosphorus bomb, which was primarily used for marking.
Okay.
I put one down one time out of the area, and we used that for a reference. Bear in mind, GPS didn't exist at that time.
Right.
So we had a lot of trouble. You had to identify the terrain features around you as to the position of the survivor. And lots of times the helicopter pilots couldn't see him. They relied heavily on a Sandy overhead looking down at the overall scene and directing the Jolly into position.
All right.
I'm sorry, Jolly is Jolly Green Giants.
Right. That's the helicopter.
That's the helicopter, yes, ma'am. Thank you.
How do you see it? So take me inside the cockpit of this single, you're the only person in there, right?
That's correct.
Right. And
see, this is for dumb pilots. One engine, one pilot.
One engine, one pilot. And what are the optics like? How do you look down and see what needs to be seen?
Nominally, you're in a turn, so the wing's out of the way. And we'd establish a left-hand orbit over the survivor. Now, give me a lot of room to run on that because you don't want to give away the survivor's position if there's a lot of ground fire. So we'd take a lazy eight or do an oblong or some other pattern so we didn't give away our survivor.
Hmm.
But we had to keep the survivor in sight or maybe a remnant of a parachute or maybe nothing more than a difference in tree shades, some kind of a ground mark. And keep him in sight, keep the helicopter in sight, take it easy on your wingman. There's a lot of things to think about. By the same token, I still have to have the armament switches set so that if I pull the trigger, I get the guns, and if I push the button, I get a smoke rocket. There's a lot going on.
Right. And you're just looking at it with your eyeballs.
That's...
Do you have any kind of equipment that is helping you see that better, or is it just eyes on?
Just eyes on. Bear in mind, we did not have NVGs at that time.
Right.
There was a prehistory device that was a long telescope that was a night vision device. And I tried that one night, scared the heck out of myself, and never did it again.
How come? What was scary about it?
I was in a turn looking through this scope through the open canopy.
No.
And the noise was indescribable.
Yeah.
And it was wobbling, and I gave up on it.
This sounds impossible. It sounds like an impossible task. Were there successful missions?
In the Sandy rescue trade, I flew five that were successful and two that I don't like to talk about a lot.
Mm-hmm. Those stick with you.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm.
Do you get to have a conversation with the pilot who is rescued? Do you ever get word, or are you pretty much distant from this and it's the Jolly or the helicopter who gets to have that that gratitude?
The Jollies have earned every bit of gratitude they get from everybody, and that's a fact. I have a great respect for helicopter pilots in rescues, as evidenced in some of the hurricane rescues. In terms of my own personal experience, one man still keeps in touch almost every Christmas. He writes emails, and we've both achieved an age, a certain age now. Do I have to define that? And we both have a certain respect for life and freedom that we could not have gotten any other way.
Yeah. Why did you go in the first place? Did you know you were going to Vietnam?
Yes, I knew that out of pilot training that I was going to take the Skyraider. It was a goal in life. It's a hard thing to describe, Lori, but can you imagine having this big machine wrapped around you? The aluminum womb is what we refer to it as. And being able to operate in a really hostile environment all by yourself with one engine and make it work, make it go.
Yeah.
Take care of things. As a personal goal, it was very satisfying, really. As a much larger goal, I talked to some of the folks that we worked with over a period of time, and they were very appreciative of the American presence there. Freedom is something that the human spirit wants.
As we are watching the Ken Burns documentary, I want to talk a little bit about secrets, and I don't mean secrets in a negative way necessarily, but things that are not revealed until years after the war, such as where you were doing your missions. Were there things that you had to keep very close to your chest, and for how long did you have to keep the secrets of what you did in Southeast Asia from just having general conversations?
It was very specific, and it was in writing. I separated from the Air Force. We were forced out, and I failed to make major. Don't know why. In 1974. And at that time, I signed a 25-year agreement that any discussion of the war in Cambodia or Laos was punishable by 10 years or $25,000. So you treat that with great respect. That finally dropped off in 1999, I believe. And I remember Lieutenant Colonel Carlson at one of our reunions saying, so far as I know, boys, you can talk about anything you want to now.
What was the difference? Did it feel like a burden for you to not really be able to reveal the details of your service at that time?
Burden is a hard word to define, Lori. It was not comfortable, put it that way, because I knew we were lying at a level. But it was the official position. So it's always been my thing not to challenge authority within reason. The idea is that somebody up there probably knows more than I do, and therefore we should take those orders, follow them, and make it work somehow.
Yeah. I think that maybe needs to be explained for people who haven't been in the military. You hear a lot of, well, you should make a different decision. But the chain of command does not work that way in the military. And you really want the chain of command to work, or the whole operation doesn't work, right?
Exactly right. From the overview of, we all talk about the ivory tower and all the generals are somewhere in the ether somewhere and overseeing things. And their view is such that each piece of this big machine has to do its part. And this is hard to figure out sometimes when you're the piece of the machine that has to do something. The rescue at Sante is a classic example. Those guys really gathered in the dark to be in some place at a specific time. It just so happened our guys weren't there anymore, which is a darn shame. But the raid itself went off quite well.
When we talk about the legacy of Vietnam in South Dakota, in America, what are some of the first things that come to mind about how your experience in Vietnam impacted your personal life in the years that followed? It's a big question.
Boy, that's a huge question. Yeah. I would like to tell a little story on that one. We were actually based at Nakhon Phnom in Thailand, and I was uptown one day with some of the guys, and they had wandered off shopping. I was standing at the foot of the Ho Chi Minh clock in downtown Nakhon Phnom, and I was thinking, this is kind of ironic. The fellow that we're fighting is also honored here, and that seemed kind of strange. So I struck up a conversation with an elderly fellow, and the elderly are treated with a great deal of respect. And in my own way, within the language, I tried to be reasonable with the guy, and respectful. And we wound up talking about the weather. The monsoon seasons weren't quite right that year, so the agricultural community was having its problems. We wound up talking about kids, and he said, Puchai number 10, which freely translates children, young boys in that particular case, are coming apart at the seams here. Which, in retrospect, I thought his final thought, before I leave that, his final thought was, the local government there in Thailand didn't know what they were doing. And I thought, you know, how universal is that discussion?
Right.
We deal with the weather, with the behavior of children, and the government.
Yeah.
And it's a universal thing. And it struck me that how, in the middle of nowhere, here this old guy was, and we were talking like that.
As I watched the first episode of the Vietnam War documentary, that seemed to be a recurring theme, where governments, had a certain amount of corruption, and governments had a certain, there were miscommunications, there were letters not delivered. Mm-hmm. As you unpack history, all these stories come out. Have you unpacked, will you be unpacking the Vietnam War forever?
Forever.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because it's so many various memories. There are so many various men that I worked and flew with. There are numerous books out, one was written by Don Dunaway. The title is The Other War. He gives me an entire chapter in that book.
Really?
Because he asked me to fly his last mission with him. And that mission in and of itself was, we did a few things, put it that way.
What can you tell me? Yeah, it's in a book. Come on.
Our strike was near the village of Sinh Quang, and it was being witnessed, actually, by General Vang Pao and his troops. And we were required to eliminate a threat to one of the outermost troops. I'm not familiar with the term. I can't think. I can't come up with it, Laurie. Help me.
It's all right.
Anyhow, he had troops out away from headquarters, and we were required to protect them. So we did our best. And evidently, whatever we did discouraged the bad guys from giving our fellows a bad time. Some folks died, Laurie.
Mm-hmm. In your episode of Old Guys and Their Airplanes, you're talking to John Mollison and really talking about the rules of war and how they were slightly different in Vietnam than really how you'd been trained and your understanding of them. Let's talk about that for a little bit. Why do we go to war?
You're referring to Clausewitz.
Yes.
Okay. Or Sun Tzu. Okay. There are a lot of military minds that have studied war at that level. And I'm not sure that academia is prepared, really. It becomes a matter of history. They can tell you what happened, and they can tell you why it happened by studying the whole picture. But in the moment, it's rather difficult to deal with it sometimes. And war is a fluid thing. There have been a lot of discussions lately about the guerrilla war being fought within our various societies, in France lately, in Europe, and right here in the United States, two aircraft flown into buildings in New York City. That isn't war. Well, it is to some people. It's an act of war. But this changes the definition, or elongates the definition, if you will, that makes war kind of a flexible thing. Now, where do we go with this? What is it going to become in the future? That's a hard thing to predict. Now, if you want to talk about the rules of engagement, that's a different study. And we were under kind of strict. We couldn't shoot unless we were fired upon. We couldn't strike except to within so many meters of a road, so on and so forth. It was difficult. The constraints were difficult. Even though we were actually getting shot at by a guy that was off the road or a distance away from the road, we couldn't do much about it, really, within the ROE.
Did that frustrate you?
Very frustrating. Hmm. I can't describe the feeling of getting shot at by a guy that I couldn't shoot back at.
Because he was too close to...
Too far away from the road.
Did you understand why that adjustment was made?
They knew what the rules were.
The enemy knew what the rules were.
Absolutely.
How long did it take the enemy to figure that out?
Not long at all.
Not long at all.
They're very adaptable.
Mm-hmm. Did you have respect for that enemy?
A great deal of respect.
Yeah. This was something my father always, that's why I asked that question. My father always used to say.
Absolutely.
He had just profound respect.
They were very resourceful.
Uh-huh.
and absolutely fearless in terms of... I remember seeing a little kid, excuse me, with a single-barrel weapon shooting at the bombs that were falling on him.
Wow.
Now, that's courage. Hoping to set them off before they hit him.
And that's, you know, devotion.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Do you have conversations? Tell me about post-war coming home. Let's go there first, and then let's talk about the connections you might still have. But let's start with coming home back to an America that is different than when you left.
Profoundly different. The liberal community had pretty well taken over, and I'm not too sure how far I want to pursue that one, Lori, because it's... it's
you know,
a difficult
I think,
subject.
I think in the Ken Burns documentary, and I already got an email the other day, you know, with a criticism,
mm-hmm.
and I'm not saying I agree or disagree with it, but there's just going to be a lot about protesters and folks who oppose the war here at home and the impact of that. So I think now is the perfect time to have the difficult conversation on both sides to say, how did it affect you at that time, knowing that there were civilians who were sort of standing up and addressing the government, addressing service members as they came home. You know, what were your thoughts at that time? And then let's jump forward and say your thoughts now.
Go from there,
we
yeah.
could be here all day, happily.
Happily going. Remember that my Vietnam service was 68, 69. So I was over there when the Chicago riots occurred.
Hmm.
And being as how my home is in Dalton, which is on the suburb on the south side of Chicago, that was a little near and dear. And it was upsetting at several levels. Professionally speaking, is this a kind of a limited war going on within our country? What's happening here? This was reinforced when we got back in 1974 and I got out of the Air Force. And this is not the America that I left. It just simply was not the same. There were young folks who were being openly disobedient, disrespectful. Things were not good. Not good, Laurie. I was not comfortable with how things had changed.
Did they have a role what is the role of civilians in times of war? When there are... Go ahead.
Yeah, you know, you're dancing around a point there. Civilian control of the military is absolutely necessary. We cannot have a military coup,
right.
To take out the government. I'm sorry, that's something we cannot have. And fortunately, there were some folks who designed this system that really used their heads. Our 200-year experiment in democracy is going along quite well, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
And I agree with civilian control. Now, as far as the civilians themselves, I had interacted with a couple of different folks. There was a civilian on the flight line that was involved in secure communications that I had actually worked with when I first got into the Air Force. And Smitty didn't remember me, but he knew the surrounding and the area at Lackland Air Force Base where we met. And after a while, he said, yep, you were there, weren't you? And the civilian side of it, in terms of support, was overall really good. Really good. Now, in terms of the protests, that's the other side of the coin.
Hmm.
Hmm.
What kind of conversations do you have with other Vietnam veterans? What do you, grandkids, the weather, and why governments don't
and why governments are
yet?
Such a massive failure. To this day, certain things stand out. There's a man by the name of Furtak down in Tucson that I flew an entire mission with him without using the radio. You reach a point where you cannot always rely when you've only got one engine, one generator, and one radio. Things don't always work the way you want them to. And I have no idea why I did it, but purely on a training basis, I responded to Captain Furtak at that time with a double click on the microphone.
Hmm.
And he knew what that meant. And for the rest of that mission, I did not talk at all, not one word, just tick, tick. And he knew that I knew what he wanted, a frequency change, a particular checklist, set him up for strike. He knew that I would be there, and he knew where I would be. And we trusted each other completely. To this day, I'd fly with that old dog anywhere, bless his heart. He's a heck of a man.
That bond lasts. The bond between.
Yes, it does. Mm-hmm. I call him every once in a while. A classmate of his was Steve Ritchie, was a guy that was an ace in one mission in Vietnam. I bumped into Steve up at Fargo when we were doing the Medal of Honor winners.
Right.
And Steve happened to be there, and I looked at that name for a long time and said, I know you. I've heard your name. And he knew my roommate, Jack Hudson. And from there, it was floodgate. We just opened up and we talked to each other. And finally, I called Ron Furtak to see what was going on, and he knew him also.
Mm-hmm.
So we'd.
This isn't the same Jack Hudson we had in the show yesterday.
No.
No, okay.
He's, unfortunately.
Because he was retired general in the Air Force. You never know.
You never know.
Yeah.
We are a small community. That's true.
70 years. Birthday yesterday.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Rich Hall, I want to say thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Lori, I appreciate your efforts and what you're doing here. Thank you. Thank you for being here, and thank you for what you're doing.
It's not about us.
It isn't.
You said that before we started.
I do that.
Rich Hall is a veteran of Vietnam. If you want to see more on his story, check out John Mollison's Old Guys and Their Airplanes. John Mollison interviewed Rich and drew sweet Marlene down to her scuff marks. We'll put a link up on our website.